Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Today, we're going to talk about a serious subject, but with somebody who's so nice. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Dr. O is the Chief Medical Officer at Hawksworth Blood Center. And there's nothing more important to our medical community than making sure they have enough blood. And Dr. O's kind of in charge of that. So it's going to be a good conversation.
And he's kind of an interesting guy, I think. So we're going to figure out who Dr. O is. And I think he's got some news for us, I think, too, that we'll get into.
My favorite kind of guest.
All right.
I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everybody. Sherry, I feel like we've been attached to the hip lately.
I know. I love it. I am running on very little sleep last night, and by the time this podcast, we'll have it up online. The Inquirer hosted a 6-panel forum on the Cincinnati Southern Railway proposed sale.
Right. Yes. Dramatic.
Did I put you to sleep by accident?
No. But you know what?
I definitely didn't last night.
When we talked about doing this forum, let me back up. So, this proposed sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway, we've done a lot of stories. We've published a lot of opinions, pro and con. We have even endorsed as an editorial board the plan to sell the railroad, the railway. But we are the platform for discussion on important topics. And many times we extend this platform out to public forums, real life events, not just, you know, in our print edition, online, but to give the community the opportunity to gather and hear directly from the people who are making decisions that have an impact on our lives. And so we did that with the proposed railway when we first started talking about this idea. I thought, yeah, that's important. We should do it, but not the sexiest topic to talk about.
I mean, I love might talking be a little, about well, it, but I'm a weirdo.
You're a wonk. you're a government policy wonk. But will the average person really care one way or the other?
The nuances
about this?
It could be,
it's a little technical. It could be a little bit of a yawner as a forum. But let's see. Let's put it out there. No, this was not a yawner, Sherry. This was a little bit.
I like to call it a spirited debate.
A very spirited debate.
I did think, and I. Perhaps some of the panelists do not agree with me. I think everybody got to make their point. Everybody, we had a rail expert. We had somebody from the state who the state lawmakers really put the safeguards in to protect the trust that's going to be created with the sale. Proponents, the mayor, the railroad board president, and opponents who are, you know, really concerned about some of the projections that have been made. Adam Kaler and Tom Brinkman, a spending watchdog. And so it was quite the cast of characters.
So I have a few takeaways.
Ooh,
and tell me if you think that I'm on the money here or if I'm
okay, let's do this. All right.
All right. So first of all,
we did not pre-discuss this.
No. So first of all, on its face, it seems pretty simple. And I'll put it in like simple terms. The city owns some real estate and it happens to be a railway. And they are making money off of this asset by leasing it to Norfolk Southern. So it's very similar to if you're trying to put some money together for retirement, you have some options. A lot of people want to buy real estate rather than have their money in the open market. It's just, you know, what your comfort level is, what your tolerance for risk is. And so the city, in a very similar situation, has this asset that they are leasing. They feel the railroad commission, the city, former mayors, everybody that's behind this, to address a funding shortfall in the budget, particularly when it comes to infrastructure, they feel that if they sold this asset rather than lease it and take the proceeds, put it in a trust fund, that trust fund will kick twice as much money out. We're talking going from what they're currently making, $27 million, upwards to $50, $60, $70 million. So it's basically a different way to monetize an asset. That's what it is on its fundamental basis, but it's way more complicated than that because not the least of which is there's a lack of trust in government right now. There are people who feel that this was rushed to decision, that the railroad could actually be worth more, that is a long-term investment. It's better to sit on this asset because it's only going to appreciate, while as soon as you sell it and put that money in a trust fund, inflation is going to start eroding away at it. Now we have the element of a group who is saying that any type of income, additional income that the city generates should be geared towards addressing harmful decisions in the past that affected the Black community. And the opposition is not one set group. It is various different groups that are coming together now. And the city, I don't think, was prepared for the city and the proponents of the railroad sale heard firsthand how this is not going to be a slam dunk. Those are my takeaways. From observing, and this is why it's important to do these public events. You can read, you can listen, but until you're there and you see and hear the passion on both sides, on a human level, you don't get the full picture.
Agree. And it's hard to cram all of these things that you're talking about here in one story. I do spend a great deal of time, anyone who comes in contact with me, answering questions about this. I will say there were a lot of opponents last night to the sale. Really, they're very grassroots energized, and there was a lot of those people there. There were some people, perhaps not enough for everyone's taste, that didn't have an opinion going in. I do know one of those people, and the answer that she gave me when she was leaving last night was just really exciting to me. Like, it really re-energized me. I'm like super interested in city politics all of a sudden again. I thought that was really engaging, and that was really the goal. Like, I wasn't there to convince somebody to vote yes or to vote no. I wanted to provide information, and I do think that we did that. We did get one major fact that has been lost in everything. At the moment, now, we have known about the sale since November 21st, 2022. So we have had some time with it. Of course, it's ramped up. There's been a lot of decisions along the way that are more important than others and when it actually went on the ballot, but it has been floating around for almost a year here. But the question is to sell or not to sell. However, we did get a very hard answer about where we left lease negotiations. We're at a crossroads. This is all in the conversation right now. We're at a crossroads. The railroad board that oversees the railroad, it's time to renegotiate. The lease is up in 2026. Norfolk Southern, who leases it now, has the right to re-lease it for 25 years per the current lease. And so we're at a crossroads. Those negotiations were happening. Norfolk Southern is like, hey, why don't I buy this? They get a valuation, come up with $1.6 billion. But the question, and this has been in the public but got lost in the conversation, is where did we leave off those lease numbers? The last lease number that Norfolk Southern agreed to, we get $25 million a year now, and it's kind of on an escalator, but 25 at the moment, is that Norfolk Southern felt like it was a fair deal, was $35 million with an escalator. However, the rail board, doing their fiduciary duty, is like, we don't like $35 million. We like $65 million. And Norfolk Southern said, how about we buy it? And if you divide $1.6 billion by 25 years, guess what you get?
35? 64
million.
64, okay.
$64 million a year.
I can't do math
and
in
so
my
that's
head, sorry.
Kind of where that number, plus there are two very serious valuations that the railroad board paid experts, there's not a lot of them around, national rail valuation experts, to give them, valuations on this. So that's kind of where those facts are coming from. And so we're 5 weeks from Election Day, and the question is to sell or not to sell. And if you don't sell, we will keep leasing, and that conversation will happen.
And it obviously could lead to a higher lease agreement, more money coming to the city than currently now.
Correct.
It would have to.
Yes, of course, because we're 25 years later.
This is one of those tough debates for the community, because we've woven in, you know, other concerns beyond where this started. But also, you know, I really think there's no clear right or wrong answer. I think it goes back to what I said earlier. What is your tolerance for high risk investments versus something that, you know, real estate, it's not the sexiest investment, but it is a very effective way to generate income long term that you can count on. And, you know, some have said that it's time to get out, that the financial future of the railway industry, the railroad industry, you know, is flat at best. And others have said, no, it's reinventing itself. You know, it's not your grandfather's railroad. It's not about boxcars and oil tankers. They are shipping containers that are integrated into all the products that end up on your doorstep in an Amazon cart. So, so it's going to be very interesting. I know that a lot of people, you know, the mayor, former mayors, the railroad board, you know, you name it. There are a lot of people who are behind this from the political class, I would say. Do they have enough votes, you think, Sherry, right now, if the election was tomorrow?
I think they're worried.
They're worried.
They're worried. When they went into this thinking that this was, you know, when this was announced at Union Terminal, which is a train station, you know, was the big hoopla and fanfare and like that we left with a lot of questions. I don't think they loved that. But it was announced as if it was the second coming. And that is not where the conversation has gone. And I think over time they become more concerned that it isn't, you know, this grand proposal that is, you know, everyone is 100% behind. I think we've found that's not true.
But I don't think we want to wrap up this part of our conversation without emphasizing that the city does need funds for infrastructure repairs and maintenance. AFTAB threw out some examples yesterday. The city put a list of priorities out as far as projects that would start to be funded if this were to pass. You know, the mayor talked about the plan for the city has been to every year repave 100 miles worth of roads. We're doing about 20 right now. He mentioned, you're rolling your eyes, but we'll get to that in a second. he mentioned the...
If those people are listening, they knew I was anyway.
The Bobby Stern Health Clinic, he mentioned, has rat traps.
If anybody thinks that we're waiting to fix the Bobby Stern rat problem till the railroad sale sells or not, that's not true.
But
I cannot stand so by there, without figuring out what the heck is going on where children go to get their medical care in this city.
Now
is rat infested? Excuse me?
The political theater aside, he was trying to illustrate a point that his administration... His term as mayor, he wants to address the infrastructure needs of the city. And I can buy into that argument because you have a lot of development happening now that's driven by the private sector. You have ambitious projects for a new convention hotel, a new arena. You have the entertainment development district popping up around TQL Stadium.
Privately funded.
Privately funded. A lot of private funding happening now that the city needs to keep up with the basic infrastructure, the roads, the parks, the services that they provide. Otherwise, this is all for naught. Like, there's a lot on the shoulders, I think, of the mayor, the city council, that from a government standpoint, we keep up with the private investment that's happening to move this city forward. So I understand. Now, is this the only way to fund it? Obviously not. But there's something to be said, I think, for a big idea. Like, let's not just roll this over into another lease. Let's do something, you know, significant, substantial, and sell the railway. So personally, I'm not I'm not one that thinks that there's any ulterior motives here other than addressing that funding shortfall.
And I'm not going to give my opinion, but I'm going to write a lot more stories. Here's my favorite thing, though. At the forum, we asked people to write down questions on index cards, and we barely got to any of them. There were so many great questions. I took them home. I'm planning on trying to answer them and figuring out what format that looks like. There's some things I hadn't thought of. You guys are good questions askers. And I had them sitting on the kitchen table this morning, and there were so many of them. My son grabbed them to go out the door because he thought they were his Spanish flashcards. I'm like, those are mommy flashcards.
Oh, that's great.
I was like, here, study these in study hall, and gave him the right ones. But there was the stack as high as, you know, the 50 Spanish words that he needs to learn at the moment. And I was like, no, those are mine.
That's great. Well, it was, you know, a great forum.
Everyone who participated.
And our opinion editor, Kevin Aldridge, did a lot of work to pull that together. We had great people to work with from City Cable. So, if not, by the time this podcast drops, we'll have a link to the forum online at Cincinnati.com. And you can also check it out on City Cable. Early voting starts, what, next week? I think, as we published.
Seven,
yeah. So we wanted to get this.
Friday. It is next week.
Get this forum out in time for anyone who's going to participate in early voting to be able to avail themselves of
it. Look for primers on all of the local issues. We have reporters covering the state issues, one and two. There are three local issues. There's an affordable housing one. There's a clean up the charter one. We're going to have primers on all of those. And any second I'm writing those, I promise, Carl.
You promised your editor, Carl. All right, Carl. Well, we'll have to wrap up this podcast so Sherry can do some real work. But
we have to have Dr. O. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Well, I'm not trying to wrap the whole podcast up. I'm trying to get us to the guest segment. I really enjoyed the forum just because it gave me a chance to talk to some of our readers on both sides of the issue. I got to talk about the importance of local journalism. I got to hear firsthand, you know, some great thoughts, story ideas, suggestions from people. So it was just for me.
I got the best tip from somebody who was there unrelated to the railroad. Thank you.
Oh, secret tips here. That's good.
Afterwards, I went and had a glass of wine at Jeff Ruffy's.
So we also have another in-live event coming up. It's a meet and greet for some of the people who are running for office that we're hosting.
Of the council candidates tell me they're coming out. There's 10 of them, but it's very much meet and greet. It's mingling. We did this the last time. There were a lot more candidates, but it's very fun to be able to just get to know somebody one-on-one, kind of float around. It worked really great last time, so I'm excited about it. And I'll be there, too, to answer any of your questions, should you have them.
You're going to be the star attraction, Sherry. So,
I don't think so.
More about that on Cincinnati.com. All right, we got to get to our guests.
Yes.
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm very excited to talk about something very important in our community today. Our special guest is Dr. O, the Chief Medical Officer of Hawksworth Blood Center. And he's doing the Lord's work. And so we just kind of wanted to catch up with them and see, you know, talk about their important work. Welcome, Dr. O.
Thanks, Sherry. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us how long Hawksworth has been around. As long as I've been at the Enquirer, I know, because I've written about it before.
Yeah, so Hawksworth really got started in 1938. So this is our 85th year. So it's really remarkable. The first blood center in the United States was started in Cook County in 1937. So we really feel like we're one of the oldest blood centers still in existence, especially a community blood center. So some of the original blood centers were focused just at the one hospital, but we have been community oriented as far as my understanding of the history is.
And we have a lot of hospitals here. So when you say community oriented, how many organizations or medical providers do you provide blood to?
Yeah, so I think the last count was 31 hospitals in 18 counties. We are somewhat unique here in that we are the sole blood provider for all of the hospitals here in Cincinnati and in the surrounding tri-state area. So if you have a loved one or a neighbor or a friend who is being treated at any of the hospitals really that you think of here in Cincinnati, UC Health, Christ, Children's Hospital, Tri-Health. I can go through the whole list. I mean, I don't ever forget some, so mercy. That they're getting their blood products and services from Hawksworth Blood Center.
Do they, is there like regular orders that they get, or do they ask for blood as emergencies come up?
Yeah, so every hospital that, you know, is has complicated patients or does, you know, surgeries will have a supply of blood there at the hospital. So a lot of times we will call the hospital transfusion service the hospital blood bank. And old terminology, we used to call the community blood centers blood banks, but now we kind of call them blood centers. And so we have a supply at our blood center that is available, especially if we have large users. So some trauma patients can use up to 100 blood products and even more. And so we'll have to replenish them, but we will keep them tanked off, I would say, so that they can supply it to their hospital patients without having to call us every time they need to transfuse.
So in our studio, you're sitting here, you're wearing your red UC shirt.
Yay.
Branded go Bearcats. Your logo. Yeah, go Bearcats. Can you explain the relationship between Hawksworth and the University of Cincinnati?
That's a great question. So Hawksworth Blood Center is actually a part of the University of Cincinnati, and that's really unique across the country in terms of the way Hawksworth is created and stands. So we have three real major arms to our mission. One is clinical services, so we feel that that's through providing blood products to the entire community. We do research. So Dr. Kinsales, who is a world-renowned researcher, has many grants and other investigators who work with him at Hawksworth Blood Center. And then we also have an education arm. So we have an active fellowship program, which I direct here for future transfusion medicine blood bank specialists, as well as helping with the pathology residents who come through. So we are not owned by UC Health. We are owned by UC, so we can provide and do provide these services to all the hospitals in the area.
And you say that's unique. What is the setup typically in a city when it comes to blood banks?
Yeah, so across the country, about 40% of the blood is supplied by Red Cross. Those are, you know, sent to like different regions. So they're kind of community oriented, but that would be, you know, one, large, nonprofit organization. I worked previously to coming to Cincinnati. I was a medical director at the San Diego Blood Bank from 2004 to 2013. And that's a more typical community oriented blood center. Mm-hmm. And so that in itself is its own, nonprofit organization, really with the mission of supplying blood to the community. So in that area, you know, we provided blood to the major hospitals in the area. From 2013 to 2017, I was a medical director at the Stanford Blood Center. So when I got to Stanford, the first couple of years, it actually was oriented very similarly to University of Cincinnati. So we were really one of only a couple university-based blood centers. During my time there, the ownership structure kind of changed, and it became more owned by the hospital or run by the hospital. And that is the what you'll see oftentimes with like UCLA or Mayo Clinic or those types of places that have their own blood collection centers are more hospital-oriented rather than university-oriented.
So let's segue now into the Dr. O story, because you sort of touched on that a little bit. No, that's what we like to do on this podcast is give people, our listeners, an idea of, you know, the people behind some of our institutions and newsmakers and all of that. So your career started out west. You mentioned Stanford and San Diego.
So I'm going to go all the way to
do it.
Yeah, let's hear it.
My grandfather. No. well, my parents, I'll start with my parents. So my parents are actually Korean immigrants. So they met in New York City when they were very young people. I was born their last child in Wisconsin. My dad was a university professor at UW-Whitewater, and I grew up and in Whitewater, Wisconsin. And I did my grade school, high school there, and went to undergrad and medical school in Wisconsin in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. Go Badgers.
Yeah.
I know they took a football coach that may rub some listeners the wrong way, but
we won't talk about
that. Don't get Burl riled up this morning, please.
I mean, it's just the grand tradition of UC losing its best coaches desirable ways. So we'll just leave it at that. Yeah. Brian Kelly. Anyway,
we can edit that out. So then after I did my medical school, I went to Cleveland Clinic Foundation, and I did a pathology residency. And so that was actually at the time 5 years. So 2 years of anatomic pathology, 2 years of clinical pathology, and then a qualifying year to sit for boards. I guess I'll go into this. After that, I was not sure I wanted to practice medicine. Very, very weird. But, you know, you do all this specialization. But I got interested in computers and computer systems. And so I went to University of Utah and I entered a master's program in medical informatics. So that's very different than it is today. So I'll tell you, in 1999, I met my wife on AOL. That's kind of the time frame that we're talking about here.
You know,
and then we went to Utah together.
I'm not surprised.
I
still get emails from subscribers with AOL email addresses, which I know. Yeah.
But were you in a chat room like about the medical profession or like on a dating part of it?
Oh, gosh. Should I tell the story? So, you know, I sign up on AOL and I call in with my 9200 baud, you know, system. So it let beep, boom, you know. Yeah. And I was just, you know, fooling around with the internet. It was kind of a newer thing. And I have a friend who actually, my fifth year, I structured as my residency to do clinical informatics and pathology oriented stuff. But essentially, my friend says that I surfed the web my entire last year. And I actually created an intranet site for the Department of Pathology during that year. And I just got into, like, you know, what was going on. And AOL was the entry to the internet at that time. And so I didn't even know you could do, like, chat rooms and stuff. But my wife was working at Cleveland Clinic in a different department at the same time. And she just did a search for, like, you know, people who were on, and I think maybe Cleveland Clinic. And so then she IM'd me, and I'm surfing the internet. All of a sudden I see this IM pop up. I'm like, what is going on? Somebody's watching, you know, me on the internet. And we just started a chat, and then romance developed. So, like, you've got mail type of a thing. And
we did
internet chats. Yeah. And so, gosh, I didn't
need to talk
about
all this
stuff.
Did you think we were going to get a love story?
No, this is awesome. I can see the screenplay right now.
So 1999 is when it was my last year of residency. And then I moved out to University of Utah to do this master's program. And my wife, we were not married at the time, but she moved with me. And then we got married the next year.
That's a great story. Yes. So for people who don't necessarily know what informatics is.
I wondered if we were going to ask that or just let it go, because I didn't
just
know.
It's my understanding, I mean, and especially in terms of the medical field, is harnessing all this data so it can be used.
Yeah.
That's where you really decided this is my thing.
So doing pathology, generate a lot of results, right? So anytime you have a biopsy that's performed, that's anatomic pathology, and you get a diagnosis right from looking under the microscope and seeing what you see. On the other side of that is when you get blood drawn, right, and that gets to the laboratory. That's typically clinical pathology, and so that's chemistry, but it could be blood banking and it could be microbiology, and those are different laboratories that are clinical pathology. And so when you look at the data generated in an electronic medical record, about 70% of that data that's really useful comes from the laboratory. And so we felt like, gosh, we're generating all this information. You know, part of our job as pathologists is to transform that into knowledge, right? And so there was a lot of interest in informatics, you know, from pathology. I think over time, the people who order and use the tests have really steered the way that electronic medical records appear to us and are used. But I think pathology still plays a large role in terms of how that information is generated and transmitted to the clinicians who are using it.
So how does that lead you then to where you are now?
So I did 2 years at a master's program at University of Utah. And during that time, I didn't even get my medical license, you know, so I could see patients out there or anything. I was really planning on trying to find this niche position that I had thought would be there. It's an intersection between computers and medicine. But I found out that I really wasn't great at computers in terms of the networking, you know, building networks and hardware. And really, I understood some applications and some possible uses, and I knew how to surf the internet, but not enough to be, I think, what I would feel like was a true expert. And then I hadn't taken my boards and I had not planned on pursuing pathology. And so I was kind of like, oh my gosh, I got one foot in both of these worlds. Went to a trade show, talked to a medical officer from one of the vendors that provided key software for the medical industry. And he said to me, David, you have to go and you have to practice as a physician and use all that experience that you've gotten and then do this information processing, you know, on the side and see if something generates from there. And so I took his advice. I looked for fellowships. I had always loved transfusion medicine and my pathology residency. And so I did more research, found out there's this fellowship program you could do. It's a 1 year fellowship, and then you can go ahead and practice transfusion medicine. And so I had never really pursued it strictly going through my journey through the residency, because I wasn't sure I could really make a living just doing this really niche area. And I wasn't as academic either. And so I didn't do a ton of publications. And so I was like, oh gosh, can I find a physician not at like Harvard or Stanford or, you know, one of those places. And so so I did the fellowship. It was great. I went back to Wisconsin. And my parents are still living in that area. And so
was the whole time your parents like, you have to be a doctor?
Oh, yeah. No. So I was born and then they were like, you have to be a doctor.
And,
so,
and you're like, I don't know. There's this thing called the World Wide Web. And like, I'm on, you know, MySpace.
Yeah. So I will tell you.
I can see your parents pacing back and forth while you're having this career, you know, crisis in your mind about what to do. Like, we just wanted you to be a doctor.
Exactly. And I wasn't married either. You know, but I was doing my residency. Like, oh, my God. He's so, you know, I feel like, oh gosh, I didn't mean to talk about this on this, but I feel like I hit that crossroads when I decided to go do the master's program at University of Utah to really take direction in terms of the way my life was going. So I'd been on this path that many, I think, Asian Americans end up, I'm Asian American if you can't tell on the radio, journey through in terms of, you know, academic performance, you know, you're going to be a physician when you get through. And I really was on that track all the way through. And I think my heart wasn't in it. And so then I went to University of Utah. I just loved doing the informatics program there. And then the decision to practice and go back and do additional training, that was my decision. And so I really own that from that point forward and have really enjoyed being a medical professional from that time.
That's a great story.
I know. So you
and I think a lot of people will relate to that.
Yeah.
Not just Asian Americans, but that's you know, finding your way and all right, so back to Hawksworth.
Oh yeah, so
so you're marrying the two, right? You the what you wanted, what you were kind of like dabbling in. Your work at the blood centers,
yeah,
seems to marry the two.
Yeah, it worked perfectly. So when after I did my informatics, I called some of my mentors who were at Cleveland Clinic, and I said, "Oh, what do you think about this? You know, do you think transfusion medicine would be a good field for me?" And they were like, "Oh my gosh, medical informatics background, you really learn about process." What I learned during my medical informatics at that time, 1999 to 2001, was really that it's very process oriented. So you cannot just implement software and say, okay, this is going to be better. The software has to relate to the way that you work and it has to supplement. Otherwise, implementing software becomes a tragedy because you can't operationalize what you do. So that was the key thing I took away from the informatics. And then we have to use technology to help us in our processes. And if we just rely on us following what the software says, it leads to a lot of really clunky operations. And so I've always been interested in operations since that time. And so did the year in Milwaukee. My first job out of that fellowship was with Red Cross. And at the time, I was like really excited to work for Red Cross. They collected at that time probably 45% of the blood in the country. And I really wanted to see what that group did in terms of operations and the processes. And I had come from Milwaukee, which was a really prestigious blood center, but it was independent. It was regional. And so I wasn't sure if my training would really mesh well with what other people were doing. And so I got to Red Cross in Toledo, and that was my first job. And I actually worked half-time in the Red Cross, half-time with ProMedica Healthcare in their transfusion service area. And I think I realized pretty quickly that I was going to look for something different. And I really like that community blood center model. The national system, I don't want to bash Red Cross at all, but it didn't feel as much of a fit for me. A lot of the decision-making was made in Washington, D.C. by the very top medical executives there. And then for me in the community, it just wasn't as fulfilling. I didn't feel like I had much ownership over what I was doing. Went to an annual meeting in San Diego with my wife and just loved it because San Diego is just beautiful. We said, if there's ever a job opening in San Diego, we got to look for it. And lo and behold, a few months later, something opened up. So 2 years after I started with Red Cross, I took a new job with San Diego as their chief medical officer, medical director. And I was there for 10 years. And that really, I loved, was a great independent regional blood center. Felt really great there. I got an offer in 2013 to join Stanford, and so that was part of my Asian-ness kind of came back again, and it was funny.
The destiny.
Yeah, my dad. I'll share this. I told him that we were going to move to Stanford, and he's like, he had tried to get into Stanford as a student and wasn't able to, and so it was quiet for a second, and he's like, you always are so lucky. Uh-huh. And he said, he's like, you went to University of Wisconsin. Like,
how did you get to Stanford from there?
Yeah. So bad. But anyway, I was there from 2013 to 2017. And then, unfortunately, when we moved there, we sold our house and it was really rough real estate, in San Diego, 2013, if we can go back in time. And so we ended up renting a house in Stanford area. So I was a super commuter. And so I drove 2 hours in and 2 hours out every day. So 4 hours in the car and just wasn't sustainable, over time. And so position opened up in Cincinnati. We kind of felt like we want to get back to the Midwest.
Wait, what's your commute now?
It's about 30 minutes.
There's just not a commute here.
Yeah.
We're very lucky.
I'm glad it's actually that long so I can listen to audiobooks still, during the time.
And podcasts.
Yes.
That's so Cincinnati would be my favorite podcast to listen to during my 18-minute commute. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So for people who know about giving blood, they have their places that they go to or they participate in blood drives. But what would you say is something people don't know about now that would be good to talk about?
So I think that, when I was right after I trained, when I was going to medical school, everything was about HIV, right? And it was just such an amazing, transformational event that happened in the industry. And so we dedicated a lot of time and effort into testing. And I think people would be surprised at the exquisite sensitivity of our testing today, where we really very rarely see transfusion transmission of HIV or hepatitis C or hepatitis B. And those in the old days used to be just a dramatic thing. And so we've expanded that testing into West Nile virus testing. We were doing Zika at the time when that was a concern. And the testing just keeps, evolving over time. And so that blood actually is very safe in terms of coming to donate and receiving blood is very safe at this point.
I think when people are in life or death situations, they are more accepting of a transfusion than they might be with the idea of it in general.
Yes.
But talk about it from the donor side a little bit. Like, what are the barriers that you face as an organization to get people to donate? How do you manage? Like, I think I hear about Hawksworth usually involving there's a shortage and people are, you know, making a call for a rare type of blood or whatever. But what, just day in and day out, what are some of the barriers and how do you maintain the supply?
That's a great question, Burl. So we can try to scare donors to come in, right? So we could have like, the animal commercials with like, oh, this dog is going to
die. The Sarah McLaughlin commercials.
Yeah. Beautiful music and stuff.
I was going to sing again 2 podcasts in a row.
Remember
those commercials. Yeah.
I think you found your spokesperson. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Let me take that back to the office. So we could do that approach. And I don't want to say that that's a horrible, I mean, I love Sarah McLaughlin. But I don't think that that's the image we want, right, for the blood center, mm-hmm. is that please come and donate or people are going to die, you know, but essentially that kind of is. But I think that we can appeal to donors in a more positive way and still have them come out. So I think from time to time you'll hear us give messages that are like urgent need or, you know, and that's real because platelets, when we collect them, only last for 7 days after collection and we can't release them until 2.5 or 3 days after we collect them. So they're essentially 4 days of shelf life in the hospital. And it's like keeping lettuce in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I would imagine, I've never run a grocery store, but I think it's very hard to do that. So we can have these appeals from time to time, but people get tone deaf to them, right? And so when I think about our donors, how can we get them to come out? It really is like, what are the benefits of donating? I don't want to push any physical benefits of donating. We do many physical. We do. I've really been hesitant to do that. People donate out of the goodness of their hearts. And there's risk associated with donation, right? So you could faint afterwards. Everybody knows these. You could faint. Mm-hmm. You could get a bruise afterwards. You know, you could, you know, and then we're going to invite you to come in, spend an hour with us if you're going to donate whole blood. We're going to ask you a bunch of really personal questions. We're going to, have a
what's your sex life
draw.
Like?
Yeah, yeah. No, and then you're going to donate. And so what I really try to impress upon the donors is like when you come and donate, you are actually strengthening the community and you're an important part of the community and you're building bonds to the communities, which is, which is great. That's why I love the regional blood center approach that we have here at Hawksworth that the independent blood centers really have. You are giving. We don't know. The recipient will not know if you're black, white, brown, anything. The recipient, when they receive the blood, they don't know if the donor was black, white, brown, whatever. But you know when you give your – and the symbology is there too, right? So you know when you give your blood, your life forces, your fluid to us, that we're going to generate that into good. And you should, when you leave after donating, you should have been thanked about 20 times by our staff and feel like, wow, people are looking for community engagement and that you have done a good thing and that you're wanting to come back again and donate again to help somebody else. And you don't know exactly who's going to receive that. You don't exactly know why, but you know that there's a need for this and you're supplying that need. And it's out of the goodness of your heart. It's not because we're paying you for that. It's a t-shirt. It's a, hoodie. We've got great merch, but that's really just the cherry on top, right? That is not, payment for donation. And so people should, when they donate, they should leave feeling like, oh my gosh, this was an amazing thing that I did. And I'm part of this community and I've contributed to it. So that's kind of, I think, what we need to emphasize. Vivek Murthy right now, Surgeon General, I love him. He talks about this epidemic of loneliness, about, not feeling. I feel like blood donation, maybe we can play a part of that. Even if you can't qualify to donate, come donate at our canteen. Donate your time as a volunteer at the canteen. Talk to our donors after they've donated and thank them for what they're doing. And just see all these great people. The great thing about blood centers is we work with donors all day long who are coming and giving and are of that spirit. And how can you not enjoy your job when you are working with people who are trying to just fill a need that's there and to help those recipients in town as well. So that's my pitch. It's long, windy, but
no, it's such a great pitch. I don't want to ask anything else. Well,
there's a big important change coming.
Let's hear about that.
So that there has been a change in law, right?
Yeah.
That is allowing the LGBTQ plus community to donate blood, which has not been allowed in the past. This is a game changer, isn't it?
It really is. And so other blood centers, many other blood centers have already implemented. It takes time to change your system, so we all have to move at our own paces. But we are planning to implement what we call the donor history questionnaire 4.0 version. And that will allow prior to this version, we have asked questions about gay men. Active gay men, and that we call them MSM, men who have had sex with other men. And we asked them, you know, and initially HIV, you know, was happening in the 80s, right? And so the first questions we started asking in 83, I believe, were, have you had sex with another man even once since 1977? And so if you answered yes, then you were disqualified because we didn't know much about HIV and we were just introducing testing and first test came out in 1985. So that was a really legitimate question, I think, at the time. If you looked at, you know, what demographic groups were involved, you would ask, you know, MSM was the primary route of transmission. And 1977, that doesn't seem like, you know, unreasonable, right, when we don't have a good test for it. First test evolved in 1985. We really developed an awesome test in 2000 with a nucleic acid test. So we can identify anybody who has HIV in the last 10 days. So if it's been longer than that, our test would be able to detect it. And so since that test was implemented in 2000, I think there have only been a handful of transfusion transmissions of HIV, less than five, I would say. And they're not well documented in the literature. And so it's been a tremendous win. And so we still kept
less than
this
five. On record at all nationally?
Since 2000.
Nationally?
Yeah, in the U.S.
Yeah, in the U.S.
Yeah.
So percentage-wise, that's almost unmeasurable.
It's really. We tell people 1 in 2 million, but just based on projections, but that's actually way, way, way high, I guess, in terms of the incidence. So in 2010, to ask this question, have you had sex once with somebody since 1977? That's pretty rough, right? Especially when we have this test developed that can detect infection within the last 10 days. And so, but to change the Code of Federal Regulations and for FDA to change things, it takes almost an act of Congress, right? So Code of Federal Regulations is actually the act of Congress. So FDA, and they don't want to make things less conservative. So once you get a rule on the board, it's there, right? And it's so hard to get rid of. We still test for syphilis. There hasn't been a transfusion transmission of syphilis in 40 years, but we still test for it because that's what we used to do. And like, oh gosh, what the risk of getting rid of that test. And so, 2015, I believe they changed that to 12 months. So if you're a man who's had sex with a man and that another man within the last 12 months, you can't donate. And so that was online with other rules that we had about tattoo, blood transfusion, all of those stuff. COVID came around. We were really worried about people being able to donate blood still. People still needed blood in the hospitals. So FDA ended up truncating a lot of those rules from 12 months, which they knew was very, very conservative, to 3 months. So it was then, are you a male who has had sex with another male in the last 3 months? And so that was much, much better. But still, it precludes active gay men from donating blood, right? And I don't think there are any other statutes in the laws that kind of call out sexual orientation and activity. And so it was very important, I think, for us to change that and to look for a different way to keep primary focus, keep the blood supply safe, but also to allow people to donate, right, if they are not in a high risk area. And so I think for monogamous gay men who are in a monogamous relationship and are negative for HIV, that they are actually a safe population. And so the questions now will remove those MSM questions, so you won't get any of those. They also, at the same time, we're going to eliminate the rules in terms of if you spent time in Europe because of fear of CVJD or mad cow disease, that instance of that has almost disappeared. And so we're getting rid of all those questions, which deferred a lot of our military people who have served overseas. And so we currently, we have already got rid of those, but this will formally not even ask those questions. And so we'll ask two questions. One will be, have you had any new sexual partners in the last 3 months or 90 days? And the other question will be, have you had multiple sexual partners in the last 3 months? So those two groups are kind of higher risk, right? In terms of, hey, there's a new sexual partner or there's multiple sexual partners. And then the activity that is high for transmission is actually anal sex. So we'll ask a follow-up question to each of those questions. If you answer yes, have you had anal sex in the last 3 months? And if the answer to both of those questions is yes, then we'll ask people not to donate for 3 months. And so they've done studies. One is called the Advanced Study, and looked at active gay men and found that not all gay men are going to be able to donate, you know, with this, if because of those two questions. But those are the higher risk for HIV population, and so that's actually good that we are not going to, you know, have the possibility of those, you know, higher risk individuals donating, and because that just makes our testing that much better.
But it opens up the pool to so many more people.
Yes, exactly. And we aren't discriminating, you know, based on that. These are risk based questions, and that's the approach that we're taking across the country. And so I know it's a little graphic or explicit. Language, but those are questions we're going to be asking. We actually currently provide that in information sheets to donors as they come through. And so it isn't a change, but the actual asking the question will be a little bit of a change. So we'll have to make sure that people are ready for that in case that happens.
When are you planning on implementing this?
Great question. So we are looking at the first week of December. We've had to really make some changes in our operations, go through our it's amazing what these little changes, how much work it is on our side. But we have a computer system we have to update. We have to update our computer-generated questionnaire. We have to update all of our algorithms in terms of how to handle different answers. And then train our individuals. And that's really time-consuming. So first week of December. For sure by the end of the calendar year.
How many centers do you have where people can go and donate blood?
We have 7 fixed centers across the city. I always urge people to go to hoxworth.org. And it's not the city, it's the region, sorry. So we have a center in Kentucky, Fort Mitchell, and throughout the area. We collect about a little more than half our blood in the centers. And then we collect about half our blood, we used to pre-COVID, on our mobile drives as well. So you can call us and arrange for our blood mobiles to come out to your place of work or wherever and set up those drives at your convenience as well.
I remember we used to have one at our church.
Yeah.
It was a big day.
Yeah.
But have you post-COVID restored the level of blood drives you had?
So that's such a great question. So we really, during COVID, limited our mobile collections. And that was really rough because we do these things with community ties and we have all these contacts and we're like, oh gosh, we can't send a bus out because we don't have enough employees to do so. And we really shifted those employees to our centers, mm-hmm. which were more efficient for us. And just because we were like everybody, we're struggling to get enough people to draw the blood, right? And now, just in recent months, we're really starting to ramp up our mobiles again. And so we're actually looking for those opportunities to reestablish some drives that unfortunately have probably not been active in the past 2-3 years.
Well, this has been quite the...
I know. I mean, we had a little bit of everything.
We had like a love story. We had, window into the Asian American experience.
We learned about info technology.
Yeah. Informatics. Yeah. I remember when I was the editor in Reno, we had a person who did our website, and he left us to go to the University of Nevada to study informatics. And I was like, what even is that? This is like 10, 15 years ago, probably. And so I knew all about it from my friend Marcel. He was like an early, in my experience anyway, saw this as an opportunity.
Does Marcel make more money than us now, bro?
Oh, he makes more money than he did doing website production, for sure. For sure. Well, Doctor, we can't thank you enough for coming in. Again, if someone listens to this podcast and they're motivated, inspired to give blood, the best thing to do is go to hawksworth.org.
Yeah. So right. you can walk into our fixed sites, but really it's better if you make an appointment. Your experience will be much better and they'll be staffed appropriately to be able to handle you as you come in. But yeah, go to hawksworth.org, make an appointment. If you have questions about eligibility, there should be some contact information there. You can leave some questions as well. I know that oftentimes people are like, oh, can I donate or not?
And is there a particular type that is always in need?
Yeah. So if you don't know your blood type, it's a great way to find out, right? Come and donate. When we find out what your blood type is, if you're a type O, we often will go for your red cells, right? So those are the universal red cells for any recipient. Plasma and platelets are kind of the opposite. So if you're AB, we really want you to donate platelets if you can, or plasma. And so we have special devices that we collect those on. Those collections take a little bit longer, but you can come in every 2 weeks if you donate platelets. You can come in every 8 weeks if you donate whole blood.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank All you. Right. Thank you.
All right, it's been a minute since I've given blood, and I think we know what that means. I have to go do it, and I'm going to. It is really important. It's not that hard. I'm not afraid of needles. I'm not afraid of blood. It's a time thing, and that's a ridiculous excuse. Ridiculous. So anyway, so that's my takeaway.
Your takeaway is you're going to give blood?
Yep.
Well, that's good, Sherry. I hope that this podcast inspired many people to give blood. And Dr. O is fantastic. Great backstory with him. You can tell he's passionate about what he does. No, you know, that's the thing that I like about this podcast is, you know, we get to meet some people who are behind the scenes, who have very important jobs, learn a little bit about them, share that with our listeners. And he was, you know, another guest that I think ended up being his backstory was,
I know, a delight.
Was great. Yeah. So, all right. So I have a quick little sensei moment here. Guess what I did for the first time in my life as pretty much a lifelong Cincinnatian, sort of.
Tell me, because I think I might know, but from your wife.
I went to a Catholic church on the West Side on a Friday night and played bingo.
Oh, I don't know this. I thought you were going to say you went to the Coleraine Oktoberfest.
No. Well, you know, the Donna Schwaben event. Yeah, we did that too. That's, Oh my gosh. There's so many things happening now. Okay. But no. So my wife, Lauren, grew up in Northern Kentucky, loved to go play bingo with her grandma. All right. That was what they did. Grandma took Lauren and her sister to play bingo. And that's back when they let kids in the bingo hall. They don't do that anymore in a lot of cases because, you know, it is gambling. Right. And so she has been looking to go to bingo for the longest time. And we finally had a Friday night. We weren't doing anything. And so we drove all the way from Blue Ash to Bridgetown, went to St. Jude and played bingo and had a ball.
That does sound fun.
I think we should schedule a bingo night. The people were wonderful there.
We could have like a work bingo night. How fun would that be?
So like I haven't played bingo. The only time I played bingo is when William was in elementary school, the PTA had bingo night. And this was very kid friendly and very simple bingo where all you're doing is trying to get like a line, you know, like a cross or diagonal or whatever. Not at a real bingo event. I mean, there were like...
It's competitive.
I mean, four corners, crazy L's, J's, crosses, prison bars, all these weird combinations to do it. In the middle, if you've played bingo, you know all this, so I'm acting like this is a brand new thing, but they had all these like you get at Catholic church festivals, the pull-off things and the scratch-offs and things like that. So while I'm trying to like use my dauber or dabber, we were arguing about the pronunciation for it.
Using
my dabber, trying to like keep up because they call those numbers so fast. There's people running around saying, flash this, all these different kind of games. And Lauren's buying all these like games and ripping off these pull tabs. She won $50.
Wow.
We probably spent $100.
How?
But anyway.
How many people were there?
Oh, I would say I'm just ballparking it. Probably 100 or more.
That sounds fun to me.
Yeah. It was in the Undercroft of St. Jude, and it was a big space, and it was filled.
On a Friday night,
Friday night. They do it, I think, the first, third, and fifth if there is a fifth Friday of the month. So anyway, you can go online probably and find hundreds of places to play bingo. That's just where we ended up. And I sat there thinking, okay, well, I've got a That's So Cincinnati moment because that was so Cincinnati. And of course, when it was over, we were hungry and we ate at the Bridgetown Skyline. And it was right after Elder got beat by Moeller. And so all these Elder fans were coming in with these long faces, very sad. And I was just like soaking in, you know, the whole, you know, Catholic school football rivalry. It was just one of those nights. But yes, I can cross that off on my Cincinnati bucket
list.
That
is a very Cincinnati
thing. Played bingo on a Friday night.
All right. I found out on Friday night that I somehow managed to get in People magazine. That was my highlight of the weekend. From when I went to see Kelly Clarkson, I guess People was there. And so Friday night, we were at like just a house party. And I got a text. They're like, do you know you're in People magazine? I was like, no, what? It was weird. And then the People, I get People magazine. And it had been sitting on my kitchen table all day from when I got the mail. And there it was. That was fun.
That, you know, that's a big moment, Sherry. Yes. Not everybody can say they were in People.
At said house party, we talked about mixed use development a lot. And we were like, Alex and I were walking out. And I was like, who am I? Who am I?
That sounds like a rage right there.
I know.
A rage you're talking about.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, though. But that's, I guess,
see, where you are wonky,
where
Sherry.
I'm at. I am.
You are a political wonk. All right. Well, before we wrap, I have to tell everybody it is October. I'm in the throes, again, of the Men Wear Pink campaign to raise money for breast cancer research and awareness. So you can Google Cincinnati Real Men Wear Pink. We'll probably have links to it on our own website, too. But
we're going to have a discussion
find out. You can find out how to support the campaign. Whether you donate through me or one of the other ambassadors, hopefully you donate through me. But this year I decided, in addition to what I had done in the past, that we were going to the Enquirer support the American Cancer Society with an event. And so the Enquirer is partnering with the Holy Grail and Men Wear Pink to have an event on October 25th. It's called Paint the Grail Pink. And everybody's invited. We actually have it as an event on the Enquirer Facebook page. You can go online to find out more information about it. But it's going to be a fun event at the Grail. The Grail's donating all the proceeds that night to the American Cancer Society. To get in, it's just a $10 donation. Silent auction with all kinds of good prizes. Live musical performance by Reds Hall of Famer Bronson Arroyo. And much, much more. So this is going to be an event,
Sherry. Did you plan this? I'm impressed.
Did I? I had help.
Okay.
I had help. Jim Mooring, who owns the Holy Grail, he's been very helpful. And, of course, our own Lisa Gillespie here. But the main driver behind this, the person who organizes all of us ambassadors from Real Men Wear Pink, is a woman named Jeanette Altano. And she is the public affairs and government relations person for TriHealth, is her day job. But her volunteerism in town is epic, and she is all in on Real Men Wear Pink, and for years has been organizing the campaign. It's done in several cities across the country. In Cincinnati, even though not the biggest city, is one of the top fundraisers for the American Cancer Society through this event. It's all because of Jeanette's enthusiasm and being able to wrangle us ambassadors together. And when she heard that this was a twinkle of an idea in my eye, she like landed it like nobody's business. So I hope to see all of you October
25th. When I go to the Grail, I am typically in some sort of sports gear.
Yeah.
So I have to say, after Barbie Pink Summer, I am ready.
Well, I'm ready too.
I'm ready too.
This is going to be a fun event. We're probably going to have other celebrity guests.
Phil, do you have your outfit picked out yet? No. Okay.
You know, it's funny, Sherry. Before I got involved, my closet looked pretty dark, mm-hmm. You know.
Now it has white
blacks.
Pants, as yeah. We know. It has
There's
white
now,
pants.
Now over the years, I've amassed some pink elements to my wardrobe because when I'm out, when I'm at work or whatever during October, I'm going to have something pink on. And as we sit here now, as we leave this recording, I'm going to go to Fountain Square for the official kickoff, the city's kickoff for the month of October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So not just Real Men Wear Pink, but other groups that fundraise and raise awareness in October will be at the square. And so, yeah.
I'm going to write a story about P.G. Sittenfeld sentencing.
Really?
Who's going to have more fun?
I'm going to have more fun immediately, but that's important work too. So, yeah, you'll probably hear us talk about it again. But mark your calendars October 25th at the Holy Grail and have fun for a good cause.
I will see you there.
All right.
I'll see you before that for sure.
I'm sure you will.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.